20 minutes after the hour. Anyway, I'm not really just, I'm not bitching at anybody in particular. And this is a Supernatural Substation. If I'm bitching, it must be Friday, 9 p.m. on September 14, 2018. And I'm Aline Pestanio. You're one of your hosts, and the other host giggling and laughing and pointing in the background is Bernadine LeBlanc.
Hey, people. Hope y'all are keeping dry.
Oh, God. I'm sorry. If something else happened over here, folks, but never mind. It's everything decided to happen like at 9 o'clock, right? Okay. It's just background stuff outside. What the hell, you know? So, yeah, I hope they're keeping dry over there. I just want to say who our guest was, like 10 minutes from now. 10 minutes. We're going to be talking again to Matt Swain, who was very exciting to me last time, but we barely scratched the surface of haunted rock and roll. So we're going to have him back tonight. And we're also going to talk about haunted country, because that seems like, you know, the whole thing. And then maybe we'll go into rap, but I don't know. I don't think it should be mentioned, but we'll see, you know, ghosts of whatever, Tupac. Ghosts of people who actually had talent. But yeah, have you been watching the storm?
Yes and no.
I've been watching.
My TV's been acting up too, so yeah.
Oh, Lord.
We have technical difficulties all over this house today.
Paranormal activity at the house. Yes. In the house, always at your house.
Yes.
Gotta kick it out. And God, but anyway, yeah, I've been watching the Hurricane Florence thing. It's not a laughing matter, but I always watch the weather channel. Actually, I've been watching it all week. And you know, it's been like waiting and waiting and waiting, and it makes you, you know, kind of gives you a PTSD feeling a little bit if you went through Katrina as I did. Yeah. And I mean, I've been through, and you, well, I don't know about Southwest Louisiana, but I went through Betsy. That's the first storm I remember. Then Camille, which was a devastating storm, and then Katrina, and there were others in between there, you know, with varied
Rita.
Amounts of whatever. Rita was your, yeah, Rita was the Katrina of the Southwest Louisiana coast, yeah, and y'all. Mm-hmm. Which came right after, a month, right? Literally like 3 weeks after Katrina, we had Rita.
Right.
And if it had hit New Orleans then, it would have wiped it out, which I'm kind of sorry now with all that's going on down there that it didn't. But we could have started with a fresh slate for sure then. But I know it just kind of gives you, you know, this, I don't know, PTSD. And so I was watching all week, kind of, you know, basically to avoid the regular news, you know. So I was watching, and somebody ought to, you know, I figured somebody should be watching these people. And I cannot believe that these people don't evacuate.
I know. Have you learned nothing, people?
From us? I mean, and from, you know, across Puerto Rico with Maria, you know. Then all overnight, and I was talking about this on Facebook. It's like, you know, they give them these names, and even when they release the names, you know, and they in the beginning of the season, and they tell you this is a list, you can look on it and you can kind of almost see like what's going to be a bitch of a storm, you know, or a bastard, depending. Now they use men's name, but what is really going to be? And I said it when Florence came. You know, I was like, look at this thing. You know, this looked like Katrina when it was still out, when the Navy was moving their big boats and everything, their big ships. But, you know, it's like I was saying on Facebook, they have a mind of their own at some point. And I mentioned, you know, it's like, it's weird. I mean, I remember them coming during the day, but these devastating ones, Camille, Betsy, Katrina, it was an overnight thing. They always seem to come like at night when all the electricity is out. Well, it's not just that. It's like they have a mind of their own. Like, you know, we give them a name, then they take on a character. And then because this particular storm, Florence, it was moving like at 17. And the dental appliance folks it's really, it's like right before I go on. So I'm talking like that, you know. I don't know. Maybe I need radio for the whatever.
You sound fine.
I don't. I feel like I don't. Anyway, you know, it's hanging around out there. And originally they had it come in like in the daytime, by like 11 o'clock in the day, in the morning. And it was like, no. And then it went, the tide went out. Okay. Came nightfall, nighttime. And then it started to move, right? And because it had slowed, but it moved, but it slowed down, which made it worse. And now it's just tearing everything up. So all last night, 2 a.m., 3 in the morning, all of the rescue standbys were getting these calls from people, you know, to come and save us, water rescue. And, you know, and it's like, you know, I just, that's risking, that's the people that decided not to stay are risking the lives of the people that are waiting to respond, you know. But like in Katrina, it's like, after a certain point, it's like, we can't come get you. We are not going to be able to get to you, you know, and they kept saying it and saying it for days. And last night, all, you know, and the thing about it is when you're watching and it's nighttime like that, and you're looking at this, like I'm watching on the Weather Channel, and you got these bozos standing out in it. You know, it's 150 gusts and they're, you know, out, whatever, standing there filming. You realize people are dying, you know, that's a weird feeling. That was like during Sandy. The ones that didn't involve us, it's like, you know, you realize that people were dying in the darkness and there was nothing anybody could do about it, you know, because they have like 5 confirmed. They haven't even started yet with the drownings and everything else, you know. So it's a nightmare. And it's, you know, it's even more frightening at night, you know, with no lights and all you hear is the wind just screaming and screaming, you know, and things falling, and limbs breaking off of trees and all this other kind of stuff. That's all you hear. So, I mean, you know, I feel bad for the people who decided to ignore their, you know, their authorities and just stay there. So, and they'll be washed out to sea. But real quickly now, because we're about 5 minutes away from Matt, and you folks, you'll hear my dog barking in the background. I really should put her as my icon everywhere. Mm-hmm. Just bark. The Nike thing that I posted on Facebook. Anyway, we were talking about what, you know, it made me think further, since apparently I had a lot of time to think. I was thinking about the elementals that are in play, supernaturally speaking, folks. You know, the sylphs of the air, the undines of the water, fire, the salamanders. And it's not a lizard, but it is. It's the lizard. It's a symbol because they can stand high temperatures of fire. And then earth, which would be the gnomes. But, you know, obviously it's air and water together, you know. And it's like, you know, if you have a rain shower, you know, it's no big deal, thunder or whatever. But when they get any element, fire, when you look at a house on fire and people take these pictures and they say, look at the faces, look at the faces. You know, when there's an out of control fire burning, you can see the elementals at work. If you have a candle flame, that's one thing. If it falls over, or if you have 100 candles and they all fall over, you got a, you know, a conflagration, and nothing can control the elemental energy. Same thing with water. So what's happening to the coast of Carolina right now is that, you know, they're just having a field day. Their kings are present. When you get enough of these elemental spirits together, they begin to form a sort of, you know, a sort of rudimentary conscience, very primitive, but they begin to, you know, amalgamate into like a single thought, like as if they have a king, and they call them the kings of the elephants, the elements, as if they have a king or they have somebody giving it direction. And so when you see burning houses and pictures of what things that look real, there are entities in there that you're seeing. And when you see, you know, storms like this and the water is completely out of control, you're seeing them in their element the overabundance of the elementals. But I think Matt is on the phone with us. Are you back, Matt?
I'm here.
Yeah.
Hey.
Well, thank you for coming back on our show.
I appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thanks. I mean, we had so much more to talk about. You're going to hear my dog in the background, by the way.
So that's okay. You'll probably hear my cat.
Really? Is that loud?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Anytime there's a closed door, she wants to figure out what's behind it. So you hear a pounding. It's not the spirit.
Oh, you have one of those too, right? That's closed, and you're going to pull it off of the hinges. That's what we got. I mean, I have four cats, and they're in it together. But anyway, it's great to have you back. How have you been in between?
Oh, everything's going pretty good, I guess. Yeah, I'm wrapping up another. I'm getting ready to release a book in October, and I have another one that I'm finishing up. So I've been keeping busy with that.
Good. Excellent. Is that the World War II? A book on World War II?
I have the World War II. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Coming out in October. And where I'm from in Pennsylvania is a big railroad area. So I started to get into the ghost lore and legends of railroads, which was kind of interesting for me.
Cool. That's there's a lot of legends behind that. But
we're
back.
We will have him back November 9th. You will be coming back to speak with us again about the haunted World War II.
Perfect.
I have you on the schedule, remember?
Yeah.
Matt,
yeah,
okay.
Forward to that. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, nobody's thinking
that'll be awesome. Yeah. Well, if his book's coming out in October, November's perfect for us.
Yeah. And
yeah,
we'll do what we can.
Help promote it.
Do what we can, for sure. But when we were talking last, we had to kind of leave off. I mean, there was so much information that we were talking about. And, you know, I realized with everything that's going on in my background, I didn't announce. This is Matt Swain, folks. For those of you who missed the first show with Matt as our guest, he's the author of Haunted Rock and Roll and the second book, More Haunted Rock and Roll. We're here to talk about More Haunted Rock and Roll. So, I don't know where exactly we left it, but we were like talking about Jimmy Page and Johnny Thunders. And I remember the last thing I said was we didn't get to really do country, which they have a lot of, you know, ghost stories related to that. And so I kind of like just segue into that really quick, then see where that goes. And we can go back to the rock. But when you were writing these books, did you come across a lot of legends and stories about haunted country too?
Yeah, actually I did. What happened was that as I was researching the first book, Haunted Rock and Roll, I started to find some little tidbits. Of course you have Elvis, and Elvis kind of straddles a couple different genres there. He's the country people love him and the rock people love him. So I knew that there was a few legends about ghost legends about Elvis Presley out there, but I started to hear and read more about Hank Williams and Patsy Cline. And so I decided I would, that was the next pitch I made to the acquisitions editors. I wanted to do something on country music. I've always loved classic country. And so usually what I do is I try to couple what I like with and then give it a paranormal supernatural twist. So I find that the ghost lore and the ghost accounts, the accounts of people who have encounters or what have you are interesting enough. But for me, I learn a lot about the people too. So you know, it was fun for me to research about people like Patsy Cline and Loretta Lynn and Hank Williams, but there is an awful lot about a lot of supernatural tales that either focus on country artists who have passed on, or country music musicians have had their own encounters with the paranormal. And it was really after that book that I started to kind of solidify what I believe is going on, because I always knew, because I grew up with rock and roll and I was much more affiliated with rock and roll, I knew all the stories of, I knew a lot of the stories about Jim Morrison and shamanism, and of course Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page and Magic, mm-hmm. and Aleister Crowley. So I had that background, but I thought rock and roll was just kind of a special genre in itself. And I speculate on that as well in the first book and in the second book as well. But when I came to country music and I started to think, now, why are all of these musicians having these strange encounters, or at least open to the possibility of the supernatural and the paranormal? What's going on? And that's really what I enjoy about writing these books, is actually the thought behind it. Why do we tell these ghost stories? Why are they important? Why are some of these ghost stories hundreds of years old? Why do we still talk about people like Hank Williams, who's passed on years and years ago? And I think it's the connection between music, consciousness, and this idea of transcendence. So that's kind of where I left off with country music, is that idea of, it's not just rock and roll, it's not just country, it must be much deeper than that.
I guess it is. I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about supernatural dangers, we talk about attachments, spirit attachments that people can encounter. Mm-hmm. And for instance, drug addiction, mm-hmm. heroin addiction, which in my research about the devil and Robert Johnson, heroin plays a big role in the 27 Club and all of the, you know, the musicians who died or had near misses and the bad luck, you know, that basically came from it. And in just speaking of it in a purely supernatural way, you know, an addict dies addicted, and they become self-aware on the spirit side. They still, unless they are able to go on, but most of them die in the throes of that addiction. And so what they'll do is they'll find other addicts. And, you know, and drugs is big in rock and roll. So there's that. But I think mm-hmm. when you're talking about musical transcendence, I think that's kind of like how it would be with musicians and music. You know, that was their lifeblood. That was, you know, that was their work. That was their passion. And so mm-hmm. we get these, you know, we get great musicians or just musicians, traveling musicians who, you know, either like one night they'll play and it'll be like fantastic. And, you know, they dream about, I don't know, Stevie Ray Vaughan or something, you know, just for example. And I think that, you know, that's one of the attractors, is that they were so passionate about it in life. I mean, I know I've seen on TV, country as well as rock and blues and other, that, you know, people have dreams or they suddenly think about an artist and they begin to write music and they get this, you know, this fantastic song, and it's like a muse mm-hmm. to them. Now, in some cases, I guess, let's say Kurt Cobain, no, not him. I mean, I don't know who died angry on heroin. Sid Vicious, right?
Yeah.
You know, and he's going to haunt, let's say, somebody, some musician. I mean, he's going to rag that musician badly. You know, anyone that great of anything anyway, but just for, as an example, you know, he's going to mm-hmm. keep him on heroin and, you know, have him playing crappy, whatever. And, you know, until that person might succumb as well, you know. So, and I've seen it, you know, like over and over on bio and all these, you know, when the celebrities sit down and they talk about their music and stuff. So I think that's where that might be where the transcendence comes in. I don't know.
That's interesting. I wish I would have talked to you before I wrote the more haunted,
well, you can write,
haunted rock and roll.
Well, you can write another book, more.
Yeah. In more haunted rock and roll, I talked a little bit about what I've been calling the grunge lead singer curse, mm-hmm. and that is the propensity of especially lead singers and front men and women from the grunge era to die. And just some of them, you mentioned Kurt Cobain of Nirvana died of suicide. Andrew Wood, who was a lead singer for Mother Love Bone, and you might not have heard of him, but that was a pioneering grunge act. That might have been the proto grunge act that came mm-hmm. out maybe even before Nirvana. Then there's Mia Zapata, who was a murder victim. She was a lead singer, maybe not the lead singer, but one of kind of the focal people of the Gits. Mm-hmm. Bradley Noel of Sublime, Shannon Hoon of Blind Melon, Lane Staley of Alice in Chains, mm-hmm. and he died of drug overdose. And there's just Scott Whelan, Stone Temple Pilots, also drug related. You know, there's just so many of those. And as I am like the world's worst devil's advocate, because mm-hmm. as I come up with a theory, I immediately shoot it down. Then I shoot down that theory. So
he's a skeptic.
When I was writing about, mm-hmm. yeah, it's just kind of an eternal thing with me. But as I was, and it really relates to my journalism background, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But as I was writing about that, I thought, well, you know, it's really not a curse more than it's the drug is the curse. But the one thing that sort of stands out about this is it's usually the focus person, the lead singer. And then mm-hmm. I counter that by saying, well, maybe that person just has more stress. But that, I don't know whether that holds up. But it is an amazing coincidence that I think statistically would match right up there with the 27 Club.
Yeah,
but to your point,
sounds like
a
it.
Lot of mm-hmm. it is drug related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, just speaking about the crossroads and the deal with the devil, and I think we talked about this the last time too, Robert Johnson died from drinking a whole bottle of whiskey laced with strychnine. And It just so happens, yeah, he had, well, you know, they were all on this itinerant circuit and they walked and caught their rides and whatever. I mean, this was the Delta. These were black musicians, you know, they're in the belly of Mississippi. But at some point he had romanced the wrong woman, the bartender in this particular honky tonk's woman. And the bartender found out and he, I don't know who he's with. He was not with Sun House, but it was somebody else. Who had this momentary, like the bartender himself brought the bottle over, and Johnson had a habit, like Jimmy Page, of drinking right out of the bottle. And his friend, whoever was sitting there saying, no, you know, don't drink it, because it was already open. And he died a terrible death because strychnine is terrible. It just so happens that heroin is cut with strychnine. But I don't know anymore. Well, it is. It's still one of the cuts in heroin, depending on the grade that you get, I guess. No, but it's interesting, you know, it's like, you know, all rock and roll kind of goes back, even some country now, and you know, Elvis, he kind of like transcended different genres, but it goes back mm-hmm. to the blues that were, you know, those driving blues artists of the Johnson era. And you know, it's just so if you look at it, like you're looking at the grunge thing and you can just trace it. And what I wanted to say was like the front man, like just take Cobain. That's the channel. That is, and we're speaking occult here or supernaturally. He's the guy in front. He's channeling everything that the band does. He's the front man, right? In
right.
Zeppelin, there were two front men, right? But as a channel and the face of the band, Michael Hutchins, you remember he autoerotic
right.
killed himself. Jim Morrison, if you think about all these people, and then you've got solo artists that everything is on just them, you know, they're channeling whatever mm-hmm. magic, good or bad, that's happening. It has to flow through them to get to the public. And so you're right when you say it's a burden, practically speaking, because they have to write the music and, you know, do all this other stuff. And then spiritually speaking, you're carrying a heavy burden. But I was saying about Robert Johnson, it's like when he made that deal, you know, they're still paying the dues for it. It's like, you want to be a rock and roll star? You're still paying the dues. You know, you're going to pay the dues
right.
for the devil. The devil gets his due, you know? And though he got Robert, as they say, if you believe the legend, which I do, you know, I do, you know, he signed a deal, but he signed a lot away. And everybody that picked up his guitar, picked up his track, especially Eric Clapton, paid the price, you know, for it.
Yeah, that's interesting because there's a lot of layers to the Crossroads curse, as well as a lot of these other stories and legends about rock and roll, that you can approach these stories from a lot of different ways. And of course, you know, the one way that you can interpret the legend of Robert Johnson, and as you point out, how his torch was passed along the whole history of rock and roll, you really get the sense of Robert Johnson as the outsider. He was trying to fit in with these blues players. They kicked him out, mm-hmm. and he comes back with this magic that transcends that blues music and takes it another step higher. And so throughout rock and roll history, you see that you have Elvis, who takes rhythm and blues and country, and he is an outsider himself. I mean, he's, you know, born poor, lives in the projects in Memphis, and he comes up with a kind of a new style, which is changes history in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. The Beatles are similar. So and Kurt Cobain and Nirvana, they take at an era where, as I recall, it was a lot of hair band and it was a lot of commercialized corporate rock, and they took punk and took it to another level. And,
yeah.
You know, so you can look at it like that. And sometimes I refer, you know, I think of this as pure folklore, but when you read what Son House and those folks said back then, they were convinced that it wasn't a folkloric magic. It was a magic. These are deeply spiritual people, and spiritual in the sense of certainly not spiritual in the sense of being like goody two shoes by any stretch.
Right.
These people are very deeply grounded in spirit, spirituality, spiritism, shamanism, all of that. And I think that's really the key point, is when the way I try to approach this, I was just talking earlier today about, I'm not an either or type of person. I'm a both and. I think these stories are so interesting to me and so cool that you can really approach them on different levels. But, you know, to be honest and approach these stories when you're talking, when you're letting these voices come out, and these people really deeply believe that Robert Johnson made a deal with the devil, and the devil came back to take that soul, mm-hmm. when he died in a most horrific fashion.
Terrible. I mean, strychnine, it turns your tongue black. You know, you're convulsing, and he didn't die quickly either. It was like so much, you know, it didn't like kill him. It was just enough to make him miserable, killed him dead, you know? So,
right.
And you're right, because if you listen to any of them that you just named, as far as the Delta Blues go, they have references throughout all their music of the Blue Devils, Johnson himself with the trick bag, the nation sack. You know, you'll get the Grigory or Mojo. You'll hear that in these old recordings, and it's like, you know, because they all had maybe a grandma, you know, who did this stuff. Or, you know, they mm-hmm. knew somebody's grandma who, you know, you went to for your trick bag, or you went to, you know, and they, even Robert Johnson, the women that surrounded him, who weren't interested in him at all until after he came back from the Crossroads, they were all
right.
tricking him and, you know, trying to get him in there, whatever, by hexing him and, you know, basically doing hoodoo and conjure on him to, you know, get him as theirs or whatever they wanted. I mean, he was a skinny guy, and the first guitar he played was only had like 3 strings that he took off a trash heap, and suddenly he comes back. Either he's the best PR man in the world, right? And he invents this legend.
Right.
Or something had to happen, and it was reinforced supernaturally, Matt. Once you tell mm-hmm. people stuff and then they begin to repeat it as real, that's working. That's a spell working. Whether you intended it or not, you'll say, yeah, I went to the Crossroads, and this is where, man, I was scared. And they'll go and they'll say, do you hear what he said? And then they'll say it. And you know how things change. Everybody adds mm-hmm. a little bit, you know. And before you know it, the magic's done. They actually did the magic for whatever, you know, and I've seen that done outside of music as well, by the way.
Yeah.
It's speaking it into being. Go ahead.
Here's something that I wanted to ask you last time, but I didn't get a chance to. So when I was working on the country, there are a lot of similarities between the country ghost stories and the rock and roll ghost stories. First of all, like just the volume. Second, they always seem to be centered around these big, not just the big stars of country music, but kind of the big personalities of country music. So that's similar. But what you don't see a lot of, at least I couldn't find a lot of, are these darker elements of curses and the Crossroads curse. And during my research, I was trying to find any element of that to add to the book as its own section. And I came up with zilch, but I did come up with one person told me that Hank Williams, his mentor, was from, I think he was from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And his, I'm going to mess up his name, but I think it was like Rufus Teapot. They called him Teapot. Do you
possibly
know? Have you heard of him?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't.
Well,
maybe. I don't know. Maybe by another name, but.
Okay. Yeah. I might be, butchering that.
I'll have to look it up.
But I would like to see if you could do that because.
Sure.
Allegedly, this person told me, and I couldn't confirm it anywhere, that he had done the deal at the Crossroads on his way to. I guess it would be Alabama, where he started to teach Hank Williams. So, there are some really great ghost stories about Hank Williams haunting, and his ghost story gets incorporated in a lot of songs about Hank Williams's ghost. There are several songs about David Allan Coe, I think, wrote a song about him. And there's been Alan Jackson, I think. But a lot of those songs are based on ghost stories told at his grave. There's one story that people have seen this misty form start at the top of the hill by his grave and then come over to his grave and just disappear. So it doesn't seem like it's a meteorological. It seems more like a metaphysical kind of manifestation. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of those stories about Hank Williams, but this one thing that I just could not connect was whether there was a curse there.
I'll look that up for you. Now that I know this, the period, I have to admit that glancingly, I know country lore, you're going to tell me probably more than I know about that, but I will look it up and I'll email you because I'm interested now myself. He didn't seem like the kind of man that would do that though.
He
was kind of, he had a whole kind of a little more wholesome reputation, but you never know. Sometimes they did it to people without asking them, and put a mojo on.
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'll let you know when I find out.
That would be perfect. But Hank, when I started, my impression of Hank Williams before I started this project was that Hank was one of those, hard-driving, hell-raising, hard drinking type of country stars. But what I found out is he had spinal bifida, and a lot of the medications and a lot of the drinking had to do with his pain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a point that never really gets out there. So, those are some of the things that you pick up as you're going through this journey to write a book.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Johnny Cash had more of a shadowy past. I've always, Hank Williams Jr., he had his whatever, and that was kind of like my era, urban cowboy era. So, but I've always heard, Hank Williams just being like an upstanding guy, not like the rest of them, like Tammy Wynette and George Jones and, the Honky Tonk Angels and all that other stuff.
Yeah. Well, Hank was later in his career was pretty much drunk and stoned, and it cost him a lot of gigs. He started showing up late for shows, and television appearances wouldn't show up. And a lot of that was this drug and alcohol addiction mm-hmm. that I believe started with, you know, I don't want to cut him too much of a break, but I think a lot yeah. of it might have been dealing with these physical ailments. But you mentioned Johnny Cash, and what I found in researching the country book is that he sort of is one of a pioneering paranormal researcher.
Yes, I remember
he
that.
He was deeply involved in spiritualism. He was really into meditation. There's a story that he used his psychokinetic powers to crack a ceiling in a recording studio. He had a vacation home in Jamaica that was haunted. And the cool thing about, he told some stories that, so as a journalist, if someone says, well, I have a friend who said his friend saw a ghost in this place, that to me is more ghost lore. But Johnny Cash said that he was in a dining room in that house in Jamaica with, I think it was called Rose Hill, with
the White Witch.
With a bunch of friends. Well, yeah, okay, so his wasn't Rose Hill. His was near Rose Hill, but so mm-hmm. was, I can't remember the name of it. But in any event, he was in this dining room. They were getting ready to have a meal with four or five other people, and they watched a woman walk through the door in a, you know, dress from not of that period, went across the dining room and then out through the doors, which were closed, and then disappeared. So he had those experiences. But then I think it was Waylon Jennings and his wife were down vacationing with him, and they heard all these crazy noises. And so the first thing Johnny Cash did, you know, the good paranormal researcher that he is went out and debunked it and found that it was just branches from a nearby tree knocking against the window. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
There you go, Dean. Yeah, it's just these branches out here. But you mentioned that Johnny Cash was into transcendental meditation, et cetera. And that is one of that will expose your spirit so much, regardless of whether you're learning it from a yogi or you're reading books and doing it. And they were doing it at Amityville. That's what George Lutz and Kathy Lutz were into. They were into transcendental, which is the end goal of TM is to open the Kundalini and, mm-hmm. you know, have that energy. And that will, if you're, it affects everybody, period, but to varying degrees, but it will send people completely insane. But the fact that Cash was doing that, and then, you know, like attracts like, he had this paranormal interest this interest in the supernatural. And so, you know, and it's weird because I've always thought of him like as a haunted man, and I'm not coining that now. He just looked, you know, he was the man in black, and, you know, he was like, to me, it was just almost like this melancholy. And maybe now I know why.
Yeah.
The spirits, you know, he probably was attached.
Yeah. Well, there's that. And there is the infamous story that he was supposed to help his brother at the sawmill. And he decided to go fishing, and his brother went to the sawmill, and his brother died. The saw kicked back and maimed him, and he died it took a long time for him to die. Well, relatively long time for the brother to die. And I don't think Johnny Cash has ever forgave himself for that. So that's definitely one element with the Johnny Cash saga. But mm-hmm. you bring up about transcendental meditation, and that's kind of interesting because the Beatles did transcendental meditation, mm-hmm. the Beach Boys did TM,
Graham Parsons.
Actually a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there probably wasn't many back there. It's something I didn't get a lot into in the more haunted rock and roll, but it's something to consider.
Well, it's dangerous. And in my book, I expose basic, well, I just write why. It opens areas of the mind and the psyche that you're just not ready to. And the whole thing, I mean, I don't, spiritual beliefs of individuals, but the whole thing, my experience with yoga is watching the lives of people. I had an aunt that was deeply into transcendental while my mother went into these occult and, you know, eventually paranormal and stuff. But she had a terrible experience. Once they get a channel open, these are not like ascended masters at all. These are entities. These are discarnate entities who hate mankind, and they're devolved humans too, who come through any channel. And TM has a really bad rap. It just does. And, you know, so you're putting a Molotov cocktail together of rock or country or any other genre, because, you know, I mean, just picture it. Even if it's Johnny Cash on stage, he had his groupies. They had drinking, drugs, everything that basically you can expose yourself to happens around musicians and happens on the road and on these notorious tours that they go on. And then when they go off, like Elvis did too, he was very interested, right, in yoga, transcendental meditation. I think I read an article where they said he collected so many books on the subject that he had this huge library about, you know, just spiritualism and everything. He was really, really into that.
That might be from my book.
It probably is. I was just going to say that. Yeah. You probably told me that, right?
Yeah, I wrote about that because I didn't know that.
I read what you sent. So maybe that's exactly where I got it from, which is good.
Yeah. Yay. <mark. laughs>
I read it. I can read. But it struck me. I mean, in just look how you turned out. You know, right. I mean, I'm just saying, at the time you're talking about, in all of, you know, like the 60s, the early 60s, or even at the end of the 50s when everybody was getting into this, everybody thought everything was cool. You know, like you take LSD and you open your mind and the things you see are just hallucinations and all. Anytime your body's vacant like that, anytime your mind is, you know, out, basically you're, you know, a vacant shell. And when you come back in, things can come with you. But they didn't think about that. You know, they didn't think about any of that. And you're talking about the Beatles. I mean, John Lennon walked away from it. He's like, he literally said, this is bullshit. And he just walked away, you know, from TM and the Raji.
Would I be wrong to connect this then that if TM is technology for transcendence and music is a tool for transcendence? I mean, I think those two could technically be connected.
Yeah, they could. Turn off your mind and relax and float downstream. That's right. It right there. Yeah. It absolutely is. They anything that transports you, basically, your psyche. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking good stuff, like, you know, I don't know, maybe like Gordon Ramsay, he might get like an out of body when he cooks because he likes it so much. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, our artists that paint, you know, they get into that kind of fugue sort of state of creativity, you know, and it can be very good. And obviously, everyone we're talking about, all of them with these great legendary careers and the massive amount of music that they've put out, but it can lead, you know, into the weeds or the darker side, because when you get to the rock, you know, like of the late 60s, let's say, the Rolling Stones, you know, they even fostered this image of themselves as, you know, the devil, sympathy for the devil, goat's head soup, beggar's banquet, the whole thing. Well, meanwhile, Keith Richards actually was, and Anita Pallenberg, they were actually doing black magic, satanic rituals. And I think I have to get this right. What happened, which finally pushed Richards away from black magic, was they were staying in a house in Sussex, England, and it may have belonged to George Harrison, but I'm not sure. Okay. And I just had another, I have to tell you this next one, but wait, when we said George, but while they slept, somebody, somehow or another, the door, the front door, there were like these two doors that opened inward. The whole thing was like flipped. Like they opened it. Yeah. Like somebody had, something had come. And when usually, when something like that happens, it's usually because somebody somewhere said, prove it to me. Okay. So they were sleeping, not a sound the whole night, but their front doors were taken out and turned opposite. So when they went downstairs, the door, I mean, and no, you know, no like dust from construction or anything. Nobody sleeps that soundly. I mean, even if you are a heroin addict, okay, something did that. And that's where Richards basically stepped back, because Pallenberg, Anita Pallenberg, was the one who was getting him more into it. And it's connected too, because all of that's like, you know, Graham Parsons ended up dead in Joshua Tree National Park, but he traveled extensively with Keith Richards and with the Rolling Stones, and he was always hoping to get an album out, to do something with the Rolling Stones or whatever. And, you know, they used to go and do rituals in Joshua Tree, where we all know, well, you know, those of us who grew up, when we grew up, Graham Parsons ended up dead and burned by his two friends. You know, that's a whole story in itself, but it's just weird, these connections. But yeah, Keith said, that's it, which was a wise move, but he descended into heroin abuse right after that. I mean, that's when his heroin abuse really kicked in. So, you know, I don't know, but how can that be? Who did that? Nobody did it as a joke. You know, I mean, there would be evidence that something supernatural happened, and it was enough to push him back, and it eventually pushed her away from it too.
And there is the other story that Brian Jones, who was the founder of the Rolling Stones, he actually just went to, right before he died, he went to Morocco, and he was recording some of the drummers down there. And he was convinced that one of the shamans in the, or drummer, had put a curse on him. So,
yeah. Well, and then he was convinced.
That was a particularly dark era for the Rolling Stones. I think a lot of those bands, that's kind of when they got into heroin, and also that Brian Jones and then dies months later.
Yeah, he was found at the bottom of a pool. He drowned in I think July or whatever. But do you know that? And when I was writing my story article about Robert Johnson, that the Rolling Stones were formed, Brian Jones, they were a blues band. He wanted to form a blues band because the blues was just taking all the oxygen for all these British musicians early in the 60s. He put an ad into the New Musical Express looking for members who were interested in forming a jazz band. Or, I'm sorry, a blues band. And Keith and Mick decided to answer him and put, meet me here at such and such a club or whatever, or come here at this time. And they were playing when they walked in. When Keith and Mick walked in, they were practicing Dust My Broom by Elmore James, which is the song that James stole from Robert Johnson and claimed as his own. I mean, you know, there you go. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Keith Richards and Graham Parsons later. Well, Brian ends up dead, right? And he was 27 years old, which you know. Keith goes on to work with, the only thing he collaborated with was a song with Graham Parsons. I can't remember. No, he was with Graham Parsons, I think, that they collaborated on a Robert Johnson song. And I can't think of the song, what it is, but they redid the whole thing and they took credit for it. It says K. Richards and G. Parsons. Keith Richards became a raving heroin addict. Graham Parsons ended up dead. They stole a Robert Johnson song. Same thing with Traveling Riverside Blues, or Traveling Walking Blues and Traveling Riverside Blues, which was something that Jimmy and Robert borrowed from Robert Johnson. And until they gave him credit after, this is interesting, in the 2000s or the end of the 90s, when Jimmy Page was remastering everything, they were at their, I mean, he thought that he was forgotten, really. He thought that everybody had forgotten about Led Zeppelin. I don't know where, I don't know who told him that, but he finally credited the blues musicians, Robert Johnson, on that one song. Immediately, they released the last, he released his last remaster. Next thing you know, they're doing the big concert in London. And the same thing with Eric Clapton. When he released Me and Mr. J, same thing. Mm-hmm. His life completely turned around. Actually, he did Me and Mr. J, and then he did a documentary about it, I think, and he opened a heroin shelter in Antigua. Well, a rehab, basically, because he was on heroin, too. It's just like give the man his due, right? Because it's just weird if you follow all that. But we're back on rock, and I really wanted to talk about some country too. So,
sure,
Patsy Cline. What do you know about Patsy Cline?
Well, Patsy Cline, and again, you have this phenomena of these Patsy Cline, and you know, I'll back this up to Elvis Presley and something you said about you know. My impression of Elvis, I love Elvis. I love the early Elvis, but I always kind of had the impression of Elvis as a, you know, just a kind of a lucky, maybe a bumpkin that could sing and was a good looking guy and ended up becoming an icon. And I always feel that's after doing the last book, especially, I feel that's a real short shift of Elvis, because I believe that, you know, the volume of reading, which I wrote about 300 books he would take on tour, he was really earnestly a seeker. Now, you know, we can talk about whether he might have drifted off onto the wrong path, but he was really a spiritual seeker. And likewise with Patsy Cline, I've always just considered her, you know, well, first of all, probably I consider her, you know, one of maybe two distinct, unique American voices, along with Billie Holiday. I just think that Patsy Cline has this voice that is real and true and yet refined. And what you find is a lot of that comes from the spiritual part of the person. And so what I found as I was writing about some of her ghost stories, and there are a lot of Patsy Cline ghost stories. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably just as many ghost stories about Patsy Cline as there are Hank Williams. And I'll talk a little bit about those too, but Patsy Cline had what a lot of people considered a prophetic gift, in that she, especially when her own death was concerned, she had been in two accidents. One was really serious, and she almost died in that one. And she said to a few people, her friends and family, that, you know, the third time's the charm. Either I'm going to die or I'm not going to have another one. But she really did predict another accident, another crash. Of course, she dies in an airplane crash not too long after that. Mm-hmm. And then there's another story where she had just finished her last album, which would be her last album, and she was very excited about it. And some of those songs are American classics now. But she was so excited that she went to Loretta Lynn's house, and apparently there's already a bit of a party going on, but Loretta was in bed, and she insisted that Loretta get up. Loretta, you know, came downstairs in her bedclothes, and Patsy Cline happened to have a copy of her first album, and she pulled it up and said the first, and then she pulled up her latest album and said the last. And Loretta Lynn just started to cry. And later, Patsy told her, "I didn't mean it that way. I meant that, you know, this is the greatest, the last, and the latest and the greatest." But there were the people there did kind of think that was a bit of prophecy. So,
well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
there are a lot of ghost stories about Patsy Cline, and again, she is just such a big personality in country music. And country music at that point was very much a, I guess you would call it a good old boys club. It was owned and operated by that good old boys network. But Patsy Cline did not give a crap about that. She mm-hmm. was very into, she wasn't afraid to mix it up and go to the bars and hang out and you know, be one of the guys at those times. She wasn't afraid of that at all. And some of those places, the Ryman Auditorium, she allegedly haunts that.
Where is that?
The Ryman Auditorium in Nashville.
Oh, okay.
There's the alley behind that. She apparently haunts that. There's the, I think it's the Purple Orchid. Might be getting that wrong. It's a bar right near the Ryman. There's stories about her being there. She always used this phrase. She called all the men, her male friends, Hoss. She always called Elvis Big Hoss. But in this bar, allegedly, they heard, you can hear people call you Hoss. And you look around and there's nobody there. They say that if she really likes an act, her ghost will appear and applaud. She'll appear at the end of the bar. Some really fascinating ghost stories and ghost lore about her. The other story that I found about her is that she finally got her dream home, regrettably sort of late in her career. She was only in it a few months. But over time, it was, by today's standards, it was not a mansion. It was a fairly modest night house, suburban house right outside of Nashville. And it eventually came into the hands of a person who was a Patsy Cline fan, bought the house and started to fix it up, and started a report about a lot of strange activity that was going on. I think they had a fireplace that would turn on automatically, and it would turn on when no one was pressing the buttons for it to turn on. He said that he could hear what sounded like high heels walking across the floor above him. Initially, he was not a believer in the paranormal, and he just said that it must have been his dogs. Then he heard it one day, and the dogs were next to him. His sisters came in and confirmed the activity. So that he felt that it was pretty haunted. So he looked into talking to other people who owned the house. And the one person that owned the house, I think shortly, either right after Patsy had died or soon after that, was a country music singer. And she said she always felt the presence of Patsy Cline in that place. The daughter of Patsy Cline also said, It would not surprise me in the least that she would still be there, because that was her dream home. So there's a lot of those stories about Patsy Cline.
Well, you know, they come from an area of the country. Like, she was from Virginia, right? I think, Patsy.
Was she
from,
yeah,
West Virginia or Virginia?
Winchester, I think it was Virginia.
Yeah, from what I understand. And obviously Loretta, we knew, was from Kentucky. And I think Dolly Parton might be from Kentucky too, or Tennessee. I'm not sure. But that whole area, and these people, these, like, you want to quote unquote simple country people, they were just like, you know, just like the Black people of the Delta. They were spiritually connected to their land, to the folk traditions and the folk magic of that whole area. It's like, you know, like you say, a Bible belt, but there's also like a hoodoo belt that kind of goes across there too. And they wouldn't have called it hoodoo. These, you know, the healers, the you know, the charms they would get, or they'd go the roots or whatever, that, you know, they always had a wise woman, or they had, you know, a granny who knew such and such from such and such. So they had this really spiritual connection too, that went really deep through their music, through their lives. And obviously Loretta Lynn lives in, well, one of her residents anyway, is a haunted the haunted house, the plantation, I think. Is that what it's called? Because I've seen it on TV. Like, in fact,
it's a hurricane
Ghost Adventures was it. That's it. And so, I mean, there's a story about that too. But she had a son. Her whole story is like, didn't she have a son that died? And she had a premonition about that.
The son
died in the river. Yeah, tell me that.
Well, I think you know probably about it.
No, I really don't.
What I know is that
he drowned. He drowned, and something to do with a preacher that he met or something like that on the that told him. I don't know. I really see. You'll have to tell me. I'm not sure, but I know he died, and she knew it, and she was on tour, and I think she had come back and all because he was found dead, like drowned in a river. Or something of that effect. But prior to that, I think she was saying that he had met a preacher man that basically, like, he was on the side of the same river, and they talked, and he basically put him right, in other words, like with the Lord. And then a week later, he was. So she was saying that. That gave her comfort to know that he had come back, you know, basically because she was worried about him. I think he had drug problems and everything too. So because she was worried about, you know, him going to heaven, basically. But those people, they have a real, you know, a really deep connection. And it seems to permeate that whole area, just of, you know, upper Mississippi all the way into the Carolinas. And Elvis, who was born in Tupelo, he was a Melungeon. Do you know what those are? Well, they used to say he was a gypsy, but actually the Melungeons, they have that swarthy kind of skin, but that dark hair, they're actually all descended from one couple, that lived in South Carolina. It was a white woman and a black man, and they are all connected. In other words, cousins, marrying cousins and all that. And, he was part of that, and that's a whole magical tradition, the gullah magic and everything from Carolina. So you can't go really far without there being, it seems to kind of stop when you're going into like Peoria and, you know, Illinois and Indiana and stuff, and then you get, you know, the real witchcraft stuff and all. But just everybody that we're talking about had this really intense sort of spiritual connection within themselves, or actually seeking, you know, some spirituality. You there, or did I lose you? Hello, Matt. I think we lost him. Matt, if you can hear me, you can try and call back in. So, folks, I'm going to carry on here because my co-host had to leave. So we're here by myself. So I'm talking to myself. Hopefully we'll have Matt back on. Let me try some things here, folks. Wish I could put some music on, but I can't. Matt, if you can hear, you can give me a call back. That would be great. All right. Hey, it's just like waiting 15 minutes to hear us come on. Anyway, so we're talking tonight with Matt Swain, Haunted Rock and Roll. I think Skype ate him or ate the connection because I don't see him online. His books are Haunted Rock and Roll. Matt, are you there? I hear something on the line. This must be the hurricane. Anyway, his books are Haunted Rock and Roll and More Haunted Rock and Roll. We've been talking about all of the legends surrounding country performers. So hang on one second. Hopefully we'll have Matt back on soon. Hello. Sounds like a ghost call. Let's do EVP. Hang on, folks. We're trying to get our hello. Hey.
Hello. Sorry. I think was I that lost you? You guys.
Yeah, we lost you. Or you? Yeah, well, I've been sitting here just talking to myself.
I got as far as Elvis was a Melungian.
Oh. And then it disconnects.
Yeah.
How about a pregnant?
I think it was Elvis kicking it in.
I think it was, that's called a pregnant pause, right? Where it's
right.
Like nothing
right.
After that. So you called back to hear what the rest of the story was.
Yeah, I did. Well, I don't even know what a Melungian is.
A Melungian, as I was trying to say. Oh, and by the way, Bernadine, she had to get off. I think that might have had something to do with just disconnecting us, but she texted me. So it's just me on the line with you. But Melungians, they originally thought that they were descended from Roma, okay, that they were gypsies, this group of people that had these traits of Melungian, which is like swarthy kind of, or, you know, easily tan skin, the dark hair, the gypsy kind of look. And what they discovered was they traced their DNA and they traced their ancestry back to one couple in South Carolina, a white woman and a black man. And everyone that had the Melungian or that called themselves Melungian or knew their family was, or they had the DNA that was traceable, they traced back to that one couple. Which means cousins were marrying cousins and all this other stuff. But this was not well known about him, because it's a unique trait, but we're talking about in Carolina is the gullah magic, or the old hoodoo magic of, you know, or the root working of the old gullah women, who were, they're kind of like the wise women of the woods and stuff. And it's a tradition that it's witchcraft, but it's also, not folk magic, folk remedies, just the traitors to Cajun, you know, the gullahs on the East Coast do the same thing. And you'll find that, I think, like there's everyone that we've been talking about, like Loretta, Dolly, Patsy, even, they all knew somebody like that. They all knew, you know, they all had known. And if you read their biographies, they'll talk about, you know, the woman in the woods or the man, the root workers and stuff like that. So it's like magic. It's really what it's all magic. It's really marching along or just walking along with them, you know, and it's part of their whole story. Do you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I was just going to sort of emphasize what you were saying is when I was writing that book, I really look at Loretta Lynn as one of the most spiritually connected artists in country music. For sure, there doesn't seem to be any doubt about it. And as I was looking into her life and reading about, you know, she had talked about what she called haints, which are ghosts in Appalachians, what they refer to them. And she had run-ins with these haints very early on. There was one story that I wrote about that she was, and I think it came from her biography. She was out, it sounded like they were out trick-or-treating, but I can't say that for sure, but they seemed to be doing a lot more tricking than treating that night. And they went out to soak the windows of a neighborhood woman, and they looked in the window that they were soaping, and they could see the woman was in a chair, not facing them, looking out. So they finished soaping the window and they started to run. And as they ran, coming through up the garden was the same woman.
Oh.
And so they were convinced that they saw some type of ghost. And she had all of those experiences. There's even kind of a suggestion that how she found Hurricane Mills was almost like a supernatural meeting of destiny. She basically became lost, her and her husband. They were out driving around, and they got lost, and they ended up at the for sale sign, and that's really why they bought it. And it was almost like they were drawn to it, and it was synchronistic. There are a lot of stories about her, and as I was going through that, and you were talking about some of the folk magic, you know, I'm old enough in my, where I live in central Pennsylvania, my parents used to talk about powwow. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've come across that, but in central Pennsylvania, it was a folk magic. And it reportedly, you know, people believed in it. And I think it's still out there now, but I can remember, you know, my parents telling me stories about how they would get someone to do powwow over them mm-hmm. when they were ill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same thing. And they have that that Dutch connection too, like the yeah. the markings and the hexagrams and things that they put on
yep.
the barns.
They're
and everything.
Yeah.
yeah, yeah, and that's the folk tradition brought with them from Europe, you know, from there. Mm-hmm. And you find that, well, and the reason in Salem is because it was plain witchcraft. That's what it was that they were bringing. But down here we have that influence of, you know, the voodoo, etc. And where it really begins to mix in and get kind of where it can kill you and all is when it hits up with the conjuring and the hoodoo from the Delta. That can really do some harm, you know? I mean, but they can yeah. do good stuff too, but it can really do some harm. So, yeah, I mean, all of these artists, you know, that we're talking about have these spiritual connections in one way or mm-hmm. the other. Even the ones, you know, the British musicians that we've talked about who really came from like such a bleak life, like post-war England was just, you know, horrible. I mean,
right.
every
right.
street looked like the beginning of, you know, what is it, Tom Hardy's legend. You know, people say, oh God, do they have streets like that? They have streets where they have doors right on the street and they have their little back gardens.
Yeah.
But, you know,
Keith Richards talks about his neighborhood still being bombed out when he was mm-hmm. growing up.
Yeah, I mean, it took him a long time to, you know, to build it up. And so what, you know, they, what did they have to do or hold on to, you know? So that's why so many people wonder, well, how'd that all happen? Well, they heard the blues, but they heard Elvis and Buddy Holly and all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Gene Vincent, who was really big over there for some reason,
yeah.
you know, Bebopalula. I guess they were just taking anything they could get, you know, but everybody,
right.
Went through this spiritualist thing. Now, some of them were like putting on the stuff and some of them, you know, and that would be, I'd say Mick Jagger kind of, you know, qualifies for, you know, we're tough and I do black magic and, you know, mm-hmm. and then Jimmy Page walks in the room and, you know, the lights go out or when everything
yeah.
dims, he said, somebody say black magic, you know, which he really, this is interesting. I'll tell you, I came across recently, I don't know, on YouTube, there was a video of Jimmy in, I think it was one of Kenneth Anger's, it was a scene from one of those movies that they were doing, like one of the ones, Wormwood Star, like Cameron, Marjorie Cameron was in one. But it was in something, I think they were doing Thelemic Rituals. And he's standing mm-hmm. there with a candle for whatever. And the voiceover is not saying anything about what he's actually doing. But, you know, I looked at him. And for a minute, it was like, you know, he's my idol. Like, I'm his, you know, I'm his acolyte. But I'm like, I looked at his face. I'm like, you don't even know what you're doing. You know, it's just this realization, like, you have no idea what you're doing. You're standing there with that candle and you're in this. And they had the pentagram and you know, the inverted and all this. And I'm like, you really don't know what you're doing. I mean,
right.
I wouldn't say that to his face now because maybe he does. But you know, it just kind of, crystallizes or just, you know, refines the idea that they were all experimenting with so much stuff, you know, including
yeah,
country,
sure.
because country and rock were like, boom, you know, well, what passed as rock early on until the end of the 60s, they were like, they would like bump, like, you know, like little bumper cars and you'd have crossovers like Patsy Cline herself,
yep.
you know, was popular on the pop music charts, you know? So, and,
yeah.
and so they're always like, you know, like bumping around the same thing, but something when it went to, you know, from it took the tapping into Robert Johnson and those guys to really distill rock and roll as we know it now. Because even the Beatles, you know, they had a decade and they changed music. And I really look at them like they say Elvis was the king of rock and roll, but in my opinion, he was the king of rockabilly. Because if you listen to it, like we talked about this last time, I think I like the 1968 Elvis, the one, the black leather from the special, you know, when he tried to reinvent mm-hmm. himself. I think you were talking about that last time, how, you know, that was him coming back after all this, but he became a movie star, you know, Blue Hawaii and all this other stuff. But the Beatles, they changed music. There was nothing that was going to be the same after they got finished with 10 years of, you know, telling us, hey, this is how it's going to be. And they had the weird experience. The thing that popped into my mind that I wanted to tell you when I was talking about George Harrison, I was watching the special or the movie that Martin Scorsese made about him after he had died, and his wife was talking about, and you know how they were, I mean, he was so into, you know, Middle Eastern, into Eastern mysticism and all the Hindu, everything Indian. And he said, if you remember, somebody broke into their house and stabbed.
Yep.
And she was saying that they were standing like on the gallery and the guy had broken in and they were looking down on him. And she said, George starts singing this mantra. And he's like, going into this mantra phrase. I just broke out laughing. I'm like, yeah, that's not really going to stop, you know, a guy who looks like Johnny Rotten running around downstairs in your house. And finally took Harrison, they had a suit of armor with a spear. I mean, it's so cliche, but I guess he, you know, bought it at some point. And he actually had to take the spear and go with it. But he was like going into these mantras, you know, like, I'm sorry, but that's not going to help. You know, it's like the guy's not going to, you know, he's probably going to kill you because he doesn't know what you're saying or try to kill you. But, you know, but it just popped into my mind like, oh, my God, somebody broke in. Let's chant. You know, that's right there. That was the 60s. And you know, then he died. Although, you know, that was a great documentary about him. And I don't think he was into any of that. Now, John, I would say he was a tormented kind of a guy. I really would. I would say, and I know we spoke about the Dakota and how he haunts, you know, or people have seen him and stuff like that. But I know that he was looking for something his entire life, you know, and he hadn't even found it with Yoko. You know what I mean? So, but
yeah.
But is this your country book? Is this at the publishers, or is it out, or are you going to publish it?
It's out right now. It's only available in ebook form.
Oh, what's it called?
Yeah, it's called The Ghost of Country Music.
Oh, that's straightforward.
It's only on. I always come up with these really kooky titles, I wanted it to be Weird War II instead of World War II, but they changed it to Haunted World War II. But I tried to make the point that this is the World War II one is not the first time, because I started to move out from just the ghost lore and ghost stories to look at, I'm more of a, I don't know how you would classify me, but I'm more of a journalist, and I really admire, you know, Charles Fort's approach, mm-hmm. which is just, he's more of a collector and a compiler and a synthesizer of these things. And I'm not a paranormal investigator. I'm far too lazy and far too timid and cowardly to do that. I am easily freaked out. I got to be honest with you. So my approach is really to collect it, to try to put it in a way and make it interesting, and then to talk about maybe the ramifications of it. That's what I'm doing. And so with Haunted World War II, I started to look at things like Foo Fighters and synchronicities, UFOs, all of those, and tried. So it's a little bit of a departure. I also started to do that with more haunted rock and roll. I tried to start talking about, again, my connection is the connection between music, consciousness, and these anomalous supernatural events. So I actually did add a section about rock stars and UFOs, where I talk about Moody Blues. I talk about John Lennon's incident. Mm-hmm. And I'm compiling these things and trying to, you know, get them in a way that people can talk about them and kind of have a discussion about them.
Well, yeah, and I mean, so that's the journalist's job.
I think weird, right. Yeah. I think Weird War II is a little more accurate than Haunted World War II, but I'm not in charge, so it'll be Haunted World War II.
Well, you know, at least you got a publisher doing it. You know, I'm still looking for one for some of mine, but I don't have as much in the can as you do, though. But there's an interesting one. I wish I had spoken to you about it too. There's a book. It's an old book, and it's by a guy named Dennis Bardens, and it's called Ghosts and Hauntings. But what's good about it is that I think there's a revised issue, but if you can, or a printing, I'm sorry, if you can find the one that's like printed in 1965. He was connected to the British Society for Psychical Research. But all of the stories that he talks about were either like early, you know, before the mid-century of the 20th century. So he has a lot that come in at the end of the 19th century that are really creepy and really good. And he covers everything. He has but one interesting thing that he said about World War II was he was talking about like lost time incidents, or like what it was an RAF guy. This was after the war. I think it was after the war. Anyway, he was flying at night over what had been, I'm losing the thread. I don't know what the circumstances were that had him in the air. I'd have to read the story again, but whatever happened, he suddenly realized he had gone back in time. That was it. He had an experience of a time slip back in time, because he saw the concentration camp.
His name wasn't Dunn.
What?
Oh, I don't know about that. Was his name Dunn? D-U-N-N-E.
I can't remember because I haven't read the story in a while. But I can check on that. I've got the book. But I know that what happened was he had like a back in time experience, because he wasn't talking about seeing ghosts, but he saw Auschwitz, or he saw the concentration camps. And I want to say it's back in time, or it could be precognitive. And right after I get off, I'm going to check it out, and I need your email, I think. But I'm going to check it out, because I'm going to be wondering. But anyway, he saw full, like, everything working, lights on, the chimneys, the ash, the everything, and then he went through some clouds and it was gone. And that was either right at the end of it, or it may have been, it's either at the end or the beginning of, you know, the biggest war. But I'll check on that and actually let you know. But there's so the book is not all ghost stories, but the ghost stories that he tells are really creepy, and he's just like that. All he's doing is reporting on it. Like, you know, is there something in it? You'll have to decide. But there's so many. In other words, he says there's just so much. And he has several other that have to do with military, primarily British, the experience of the British military in different places, like in India, you know, and during World War II, and during World War I. So it might be interesting to you. They have some other stuff.
Oh, that's right
there.
Up my aisle. Yeah.
Yeah. It's Dennis Bardens. And it's called Ghosts and Hauntings. I got it at a garage sale like years ago. And it's one of, I actually read it often, because it's very entertaining and I really never get tired of it. That just, you know, the military thing just comes out. I wish you had known that before you did your, maybe it's more weird World War II.
Yeah.
That would be the next one, you know.
Because,
I mean, you're doing the journalist job, and that's good. You know, you're not making a judgment call. You know, I guess I would classify you as a skeptic, you know, but a willing skeptic. Like, you're willing to admit, I have no explanation
exactly
for that. Right. Yeah.
I define myself as an open-minded skeptic. I always entertain the belief, and I have too many. I've had things happen in my life that I find hard to explain. And I had friends and family who've had things happen to them that were hard to explain. And the typical, what I would consider not a skeptic, but a cynic, they always have these hand waves. That, oh, well, you hallucinated. Well, these people aren't prone to hallucinations. That's a real medical condition, and we can talk about that, but you know, they're not prone to those things. So it's highly unlikely that, you know, I'm just saying that they have such superficial excuses for those that it almost, it reminds me of the people who have something happen to them and everything is a supernatural event for them.
Exactly.
And you know, I can discount that as well. So I tend to go right in the middle and let people, when I was a reporter, I always knew I did my job when everybody in my article was mad at me. That's how you can tell you did your job.
Yeah. And that's, that's a real reporter, which regardless of how you think, a real lack of them today. But, you know, when I was studying journalism back in the day, that was pretty much the credo. You know, you're not supposed to, you don't have an opinion, you're just reporting the news. Unless, you know, unless you're actually an opinion writer, which it takes years to become an opinion writer, or it used to.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got one, but, you know, like nobody's a Charles Krauthammer, you know, or George Will or whoever.
Anyone with Facebook now is an opinion.
Yeah, everybody's got an opinion, now. You know, and can get on and talk about it, unfortunately, so and drive everybody nuts. You're right. I mean, that's the only way. Like you talk about paranormal investigation, and I've said this before. Bernadine, she has the team, right? She's the leader. She's a founder. They've been years and years at it. And, you know, I've gone, you know, to like some pretty significant ones too, the Johnny Thunders room, the upstairs lounge, other stuff, and slept in a funeral home, which, you know, I never thought I'd be ever saying that. Oh, I'll sleep over here, you know, with the air mattress in the middle of a New Orleans funeral home. But, you know, it's boring. It really is. It isn't like it is on TV. And every paranormal investigator that's worth their salt that isn't a face on TV will tell you that it really is. For that little 40 minutes that they get with commercials, a 60-minute program, there should be hours of footage. What it is sitting in dark rooms for hours or dark whatever, wherever you are, and then, you know, hours of looking at the information or listening to what you've got. And it's very rare where you hear, you know, a voice where it's actually going to talk to you, or, you know, you hear a thump or a door opens. That's rare, but it happens. But invariably, when I go, I gain weight. I'm just sitting there eating snacks. I'm at command center going, ooh, you know, look, it's an orb or whatever. I mean, it's boring. So my role is the team is really as an occult analyst and just advisor, like in extreme cases where there's the occult involved. It's fun for a little while, but then after that, it's like, you know, I'm going to sleep. I need to sit here for the whole night and scare yourself. I've had, there have been a couple of creeps, one in the upstairs lounge investigation that was very creepy, and Dean can send you the EVP of it. Basically what it was, the upstairs lounge, I don't know if I talked to you about it, but it was a gay club, 1973 New Orleans. And you think of New Orleans now as like a real, you know, like Sodom and Gomorrah. But back then it was very strict. They were very strict about drag performers. Homosexuals were not invited into bars. So they had to find their own place. So there's a bar called the Gemini, and on the second floor was the upstairs lounge. Well, somebody, ghost hunters came down and did it and said they solved it, but they didn't, because they've never found who caused the fire. But basically, it was a staircase up, and then it was like a speakeasy door that you slide the little thing. So, you know, it was like a club, basically, and they'd open it to see who you were. Well, somebody threw a bunch of lighter fluid on the stairs, lit it on fire, and then rang the bell, which usually meant it was a cab driver, and they opened the slot on the door, and it was an inferno.
Oh my.
32 people died, 28 of them there. All of them were male, except for one woman who was there to pick up her son, and she had stayed because they had like a buffet. And long story short, someone I knew someone who died, and his name was George Matte. The guy who died, Bud, I think it was Bud. Anyway, I'm standing there. He was found under the piano, burned, basically holding two other people, like, to him. So the three of them were, like, burned together. And if you look it up, they have pictures, and it's just terrible. So I stood. Okay. Today, it's a kitchen for the bar downstairs. So I stood where the piano had been. And I basically said, we're not here to, you know, to harm you. We're here to tell your story. I don't know anything about the gay community in New Orleans, but I will find somebody. I will find some way to tell your story. I promise. A little bit of a pause. And then this voice says, promise me. And my hair is going, you can't see, but the hair goes up. He was right there. And I said his name. And I said, I promise that I would. Promise me. That it takes a lot to scare me. That scares me. It's not so much scary as like, it's a wow moment. That was an intelligent. He was right there listening to me. And I did what I promised. It got on Ghost Hunters. Millions of people heard the story. New Orleans wasn't just me. It was the community itself was involved in, and other friends. And anyway, they had a jazz funeral. They had a wreath laid. The whole thing. I mean, it was on the 40th anniversary too. So, you know, it's weird when people say a paranormal investigator, but sometimes you get into something like that or something like what you're working on that. You know, you bring closure sometimes. That was just an extraordinary experience for me, you know, to actually go through that. And I know,
So you literally heard it. It wasn't something you heard playback in the EVP.
No. I heard it on the EVP. I did not hear it in my ear. But I heard nothing. But the thing was, I heard nothing. I basically, I said, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I promise you. And I waited because Dean's like, you're supposed to wait. Don't keep talking. So I did. And he said, a male voice said, promise me. And I was like, it's like, oh yeah, you're listening to other people's, but when you know it's you standing there and you didn't hear a thing.
Yeah.
And then that's this voice, I'll have Dean send it to you so you can hear it. It was extraordinary. It's how you get involved in things like you're doing this journey through rock and roll and, you know, and through popular music in general. If you really wanted to expand, I mean, God, you know, Michael Jackson, the whole rap thing. I mean, there's just tons of it. And I kind of suspect it started around the 27 Club, did it for you? I mean, you were just kind of always thinking about, you know, ghosts or the supernatural side of music.
Well, so I was born on Halloween.
Happy birthday. That's a great birthday.
It is. When I started working as a reporter, every Halloween, I would always try to do a Halloween-oriented story, a feature story, and one Halloween I decided I would do a story about local ghost legends, and I went out and I tried to find some stories, and they're all always this ghost lore around here, especially, and you know, this where I'm from is very rural, and you know, I would guess it'd be kind of quasi Appalachian in a lot of ways, and so it has a lot of those folk tales and ghost stories and things like that. I collected it. And I tried to get people to tell me their real ghost stories, but they were a little reluctant. But in any event, that's that collection of ghost stories. And I used some legends from where I work now at Penn State. I used some legends of outside of my hometown. And that story had to be one of the most talked about stories that I've ever written. People were finding me on the streets and telling me their ghost stories. And that's when I got the idea. Really, what I think I was doing is that when I started writing these books is I loved the Halloween holiday so much. It gave me a chance. I usually refer to it as the season of Matt. But I extend it through this writing. And so that's how I got into writing about the supernatural and the paranormal. I've always had a love of rock and roll, and I read a book called Take a Walk on the Dark Side by R. Gary Patterson, who recently passed away, and he was really my inspiration for this and kind of my hero. He probably arguably defined what the 27 Club was. I tend to remember some of the us talking about how Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, and Janis Joplin died at 27, but our Gary Patterson was a writer who could, he was a, really a triple threat. He could write, but he could tell a hell of a good story, and his research was impeccable. And when I read his stuff, I realized that you could write about this in a smart way and in a way that isn't demeaning to the people that, that you work with and that you respect. I mean, you folks that, whether you go out and are bored all night or are scared all night, it doesn't sound super appealing to me, but I respect it. So I don't want to be one of these kind of cynics that is making fun of people. On the other hand, I don't want to be someone who just kind of doesn't give natural explanations and isn't intellectually honest with things. And so that was my track into this. And as far as World War II goes, I was always interested in military history as well. So that's what I'm basically doing. I'm taking things that I'm interested in and trying to find the supernatural angle to it if it's there. And it's just been kind of a fascinating
You know what, though? Kind of there's a supernatural angle to everything. There really is.
That's
true.
That's kind of what I'm finding out now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know what? Our time is just about up again. I just love talking to you. I mean, I could just go on and go on, but we're up against the usual.
I enjoy it too.
We're talking again with Matt Swain, but Matt, the names of the books, okay? It's Haunted Rock and Roll, Haunted Rock and Roll, and next coming out. What's the next one coming out?
The next one coming out in October is going to be Haunted World War II.
Okay.
Or just between you and me, we'll call it Weird War II.
Weird War II. Oh. Yeah, that's fine. Let's defy the publishers. Let's go a little in.
And if you want any information, I'm on Facebook or mattswain.com. You can check it out there.
I'm going to contact you. I think I have your email. I'm going to send you that information that we talked about. I'm also going to send you a couple of things I've written, my books, just gratis. I'll send them to you. But I really think this is just a subject that could go on and on and on and on.
Sure. And I'm happy to talk about it anytime.
That's excellent. And you're welcome back for, we're going to have you for the haunted. And that's a subject, as a matter of fact, that I really love too. So, because my mother, I mean, I'm one of those, my mother and father were, you know, the big band era. My dad was in the cool. service during the war. So I love that. I can't wait to hear it and can't wait to read the book. And the country book is on an ebook. How does somebody get that?
Yeah, it's on Amazon Kindle. I'm in the process of trying to create a print book version of that.
Okay.
The publisher has the ebook rights, and now I have the regular rights.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, hopefully we'll be seeing it. And you're just scratching the surface with all this. Well, Matt, you have a wonderful weekend. I'll be in touch with you by email. And thanks so much for coming back, because it's always a subject that I love talking about. There's always something to learn from you. So thanks so much for coming on. Have a great weekend.
You're welcome.
We'll talk to you again soon.
See ya. Thank you.
See ya. Good night, Matt. Well, that wraps it up. And as I said, Bernadine had to bow out a little bit early, so I'm going to wrap it up here. You've been listening to The Supernatural Substation on the United Public Radio Network. Stay tuned for Miss Kathy Bilski, The Quantum Leap. You're going to get high and whatever else Miss Kathy wants to do with you. Stick around for Terminus at 2 a.m. tonight. Heretic. Creep out, follow the darkness all the way to Terminus. 2 a.m. on everywhere that United Public Radio Network is broadcast. Also, we are an iHeartRadio network, and We are on YouTube, SoundCloud, Spreaker, Podbean, Podchaser, and the list goes on. Just put us in and you can find our archives. Listen to the old shows, catch up on the Matt Swain, the other show, and we'll be back next Friday night. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful weekend.